Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Jolly, and this episode is sponsored by SSE, proud to be a principal partner of COP26. SSE is building the world's largest offshore wind farm at Dogger Bank, which when complete in 2026 will bring clean, renewable energy to over 6 million homes across the UK. Powering change for a better world of energy, SSE. Now, here's today's episode of Redbox. Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Jolly at the Times and Sunday Times Cheltenham Literature Festival. Ooh, posh. Coming up on today's episode, because we're in Cheltenham, it's just up the road, only 2.5 miles up the road is GCHQ, the government's secret listening post. So we're talking spies. We're going to hear from the GCHQ historian and David Omert, who used to run GCHQ. Also, guess who popped into my tent? It's only Ed Balls. We talked politics, we talked food, and, of course, who he thinks is going to win Strictly. So that's coming up in just a moment. But first, today's panel, picking over the news. After we didn't really discuss the news at all. We just had a good old gossip. It was lovely. Deputy Property Editor of the Times and the Sunday Times, Carol Lewis, and Times reporter Jack Mulvan. Explain what you're here. You've already done an event. You were up and early this morning.
Having been woken up at 3 a.m, I was then for a 7:30 sound check at the Daffodil. We've had a breakfast meeting called The City and COVID. It was broad-ranging. We talked. It was the money editor, the business editor, myself and Satnam. And we talked all around what changes COVID has brought, and we talked about property, how people moved out of the city into the country, to the coastal regions, which we've talked about a lot. But what's happened lately is a reversal of that. We've
seen
a surge in demand for rentals as students and tourists start coming back as travel restrictions ease. And we've also seen demand, both rental and buying, for pied-à-terres, people who moved out to places like this and further afield, who've suddenly realised they're going to have to come back into the office 3 days a week, and whoops, we've spent all our money on a house out in the country. So we talked about that. We talked about some of the trends that will endure. We thought hybrid working would stay, not total home working, but you probably get to work 1 or 2 days a week from home, and that would mean a greater emphasis on computer security, better broadband, all that sort of thing, greater digitization of things like legal processes. We saw that with a property market boom, conveyances struggled. So we could see advances there. So we thought companies that dealt in that
would
do well.
Does that mean the laborious process of moving a house might finally enter the 20th century?
God, that would be good, wouldn't it? It would be really, really good. I mean, all the innovation is out there. We just need to get it in place. I think this will force the issue. It's really highlighted some of the problems. I mean, there are plenty of them as well. So, yes, we thought that was good. The other thing we talked about was healthcare. And digitisation of healthcare. And I know you were at the Tory Party conference. We were talking about home testing. And there was a company at the Tory Party conference, which, for people who don't go to party political conferences, is a very strange affair where the middle section is a huge trade fair where you can buy tinned fish and knitted dogs and things, which is slightly odd. But in the middle, there was a huge stand for something called Circle Health Pod. Did you look at this, Matt?
No, I completely missed that. Busy going off to buy a knitted baby glove.
And it was a device that sits, and you can put it in your pocket, but it's for employers so that they can test you for COVID, like a PCR test, and they can monitor their staff. And I thought, I'll have a look at this. And I looked online last night, and it said, coming soon, flu and STDs.
Wow.
Would you want your employer to know?
So it'd be like every day when you went into the office, they would, they'd swab you from head to toe. What on earth's going on there?
I don't know. But anyway, I think remote diagnostics and healthcare, that will take off.
Also, flu and COVID, that is a thing that you could catch around the office.
Yes. Exactly.
While going about your professional business.
Yes, the other one less so.
Less so. Yes. Less so. How do you feel about that, Jack? Is that coming? Do you think that's coming to the news building?
Those Christmas parties will be a lot safer, won't they?
I'm not sure what we're allowed to talk about Christmas parties in our building. He's interested, though, that whole idea of people who got really carried away last year, Carol, and bought places. Mm. Thought, great, I'm going to be working from home forever.
Yes.
And that's not happening.
And it'll only take me 4 hours from wherever to get in the one day a month I come in, and suddenly the employer's gone 3 days a week minimum.
So what's that doing to prices? Because we've talked endlessly for the last 18 months about the insanity of the economy was crashing, and yet house prices were booming, in part because of the stamp duty.
And cheap money, interest cheap money, rates were low.
Exactly. Yeah. What's going on? Does that mean that some of the more far-flung places' prices aren't booming as much? Are the price of flats going up again in London? What's sort of going on?
Not yet. There's still huge demand. There's a lot of people who sold up who haven't found anywhere yet. There's been this supply-demand issue. But price inflation is starting to wane. I think what will really start to crunch down on it is inflation, increased interest rates, cost of living's about to go up. We've got increased national insurance contributions, higher energy bills, higher council tax bills. It'll be that affordability crunch. And also the fact we're still figuring out how much we need to be in the cities.
I suppose it's that all those things, you put them together, there's a few hundred pounds here, a few hundred pounds there, put that together, there's suddenly that extra stretch that you might have gone for the...
Yes, yeah.
You know, a bigger house.
I don't think there's not going to be a crash.
Yeah.
Anyone's first-time buyers sitting out there...
Touch whatever this table's made out of.
MDF. I think it will flatline for a while, maybe.
So that's what Carol's been doing this morning. What have you been doing at the festival, Jack?
Oh, well, it was a very exciting night last night. I went in to see Will Young, who was there in a poncho, because he's a rock star, right? Or a pop star, at least.
Nothing else?
Couldn't tell.
About seven of the people in our car park at 3 o'clock this morning.
Well, he looked like a wise man at that point, I expect. But he was very excited and very frank about absolutely everything. To the point that I'm limited now in what I can tell you about what he said, because a question was asked about Top Gear. And how he got on with the presenters of that. And he said that he was all right with some of them, but there was one in particular who he had a real beef with, and he named an episode of the Grand Tour where they went off on their tour, and one of the presenters was in a Suzuki Vitara, which they dubbed a hairdresser's car, and some of the other presenters sprayed it pink and then forced it so that the CD player would only play It's Raining Men.
Right.
And he felt this is ridiculous thing to do in this day and age, and wanted to take it up with the producers.
And he did.
Well, he had great plans to hang around outside where they worked and then wait for them to come out and then harangue them. Imagine that.
Imagine that.
Will Young haranguing you when you came out of work. but he said he didn't quite get that together in the end. Yeah.
It is interesting with the sort of whole concept of the festival, where suddenly someone who's got a book out about one thing just ranges across a whole load of of issues, and you suddenly find out what Will Young thinks about an episode of Top Gear.
That's the best thing about festivals, is that I don't think it's applied to Will Young, because he seems like the sort of fearless guy who would say anything anyway.
Yeah.
But other people, if you had them in a press conference or an interview in the same situation, you ask them a question, they'd be able to dodge it.
Yeah.
But if you ask it from the audience, then A, they might not think you're a journalist anyway, and B, they know that the audience is there, they've paid their money for them to say something interesting, and if they can't come up with an interesting answer at that point,
and it's very easy, having done these things, like, you know, you walk out, oh, there's a lot of people there. About 10 minutes in, you sort of, you're just chatting. You're sitting on a lovely big leather sofa. You're just, you know, shooting the breeze with some friends. And definitely, when we did the personality politics one, all I actually did was made a couple of jokes, which I might have possibly thought better of in hindsight. But you know, I can totally see how you sort of slip into that. Where do you stand on the innovation of having to submit your questions electronically?
It's a worry. It's good, both good and bad, because on the one hand, you can ask questions anonymously. Then it means that the journalist who's doing it, in the case of Will Young, last night as Guardian journalist, is able to ask your questions on your behalf, which is very nice. But on the other hand, they might not choose them. So if you have a timid presenter, they might say, well, that's a bit of a difficult question. I don't think I want to put my guests in a different comfort zone. But I like what you said about feeling too comfortable as a guest and saying things too easily. Because what is the solution to that? Do you have to wear, you know, something very formal, very tight trousers or not a poncho?
I don't know what it is. It's just everyone seems nice, don't they, Carol?
They do. It's very different, isn't it, to the party conferences? I've never been to Cheltenham before. Yeah. So it is
so
very different.
So much nicer.
It is. It's gentler, isn't it? We didn't have any electronic questions in our session, but I did notice at the Tory party conference, I was in a room where there was just a few people. And I was lulled into a false sense of security. And then all these questions started coming over because we were on camera and people were sitting at home typing all their questions in.
Ah, that's interesting. Yeah, so in some of the bigger venues, in the tents and in the Montpellier Gardens, yeah, they sort of put up a web address and you have to go on and put a code in and you can type. So on the one hand, I mean, it's quite good in that you might get a broader selection of people. It's not just the men with the loudest voices sitting in the first three rows to submit questions. However, but then actually, I think having chaired some of these, I think it's quite handy if someone in the audience wants to ask an awkward question, because it's not on me. Whereas if I'm chairing it, you're like, oh, I don't really want to ask that one.
Yeah,
I think it's quite good if people. But then there's always the risk that somebody puts their hand up and says, "Yes, I've got more of a statement than a question." And 3, 4, 5 minutes later, they're still going, and none of it is about anything at all.
It reminds me of the worst press conferences in the world are at film festivals.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because film journalists are very bad generally.
The journalists are bad.
Yes,
right.
And so what you have is you have a room full of journalists, and the stars come on stage, and people. There's two types of question, really. There's, have you got a message for the people of Thessaloniki? which is that's literally a question that someone has asked. And the other is, I saw your film, and this is what I thought about it.
Yeah.
And is that what you were thinking to the director? And the director will always say no. And that's the end of it. And then at the end, what the journalists are mainly there for is this: they say, oh, thank you very much. And then all the journalists jump out of their seats, they run to the front and take selfies with the stars in the background.
I've only ever been to one of those. It was for the Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland with Helena Bonham Carter. And it was because when I was working on the West Morning News, that they filmed some of it in Cornwall. So I obviously went along hoping to ask the question, what did you think of Cornwall? which I never got to ask. And I thought the whole thing was crazy. You had to be there like hours. Basically said nothing. And then I suddenly started hearing myself coming back into my own ears then. Yeah, they basically said nothing, and then you're right. Everyone just got up and left. It was a very, very peculiar. What's the equivalent in the property world, Carol?
I don't think we have an equivalent in the property world. No. I don't think we run around taking selfies of ourselves with developers.
When you were at a party conference, did you not want a shot of you and the housing minister?
No. Good question. Call me odd, but no.
Good question. Who is the housing minister now?
Oh, my God, it's Gove.
Oh, everything's Michael Gove, of course.
Yes,
oh,
well, he's everything. He's levelling up, he's housing, he's community.
Do you think he's going to do all of those things? Did you get the sense from conference that he was... Because the housing has, you know, well, particularly how the sort of more junior housing minister traditionally changes once a year.
Yes.
And then as a result, nothing happens.
I was slightly perturbed by, I think one of his first speeches was, we're going to build houses in the north on brownfield sites, when possibly we need the houses in the south. But maybe he thinks, build them and they'll come.
It's but then everyone will buy them and then realise they still need to go to work in London.
Yeah, exactly.
Which goes back to the conversation we have with you. And what does the rest of the day hold for you, Carol?
I'm off after this.
Are you finished?
Yeah, finished.
Blimey.
I know.
Just swoop in, swoop out.
I know. I think if I come next time, I'll go and see a lot more, see what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about you, Jack?
I'm going to interview Anne Stratty, who gave a talk last night on Herbert Ponting, who was the photographer who went with Captain Scott of the Antarctic. And what was interesting, and I'm saying this now like it's all true, but I need to check with Anne that I've read this right, is that he basically invented the selfie. And there's this lovely photograph of him diving off the side of a yacht. And if you look carefully, you can see in his hands that he's putting forward when he's diving, he's got a little stick, and that's tied to a string that's setting off the shutter. But better than that is that when he then went to the Antarctic, he taught all the other people on the expedition how to take photographs. Because it's not easy. There's so much overexposure with too many snow. Anyway, it meant that when you got that very famous photograph of them at the pole, all looking disconsolate because Amundsen had got there first for Norway, that's also done with a string. And so, therefore, he would have adapted the technique that he pioneered in order to enable them to take that very famous photo.
Amazing. Wow. I feel like I've learned something.
This is the beauty of the festival. Might have learned rubbish. I might have overinterpreted. But that's what I'm aiming
for. Don't worry about that.
And then readers will be able to see whether or not this article appears tomorrow.
Jack Mulvan and Carol Lewis then, of course, you can read them every week in the Times and the Sunday Times. Just get yourself a digital subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Now, not only did we talk about the news and the celebrities who were knocking about, one of the people appearing here at the festival this week was Ed Balls, and he popped into the tent to have a little chat. I don't really know how to introduce you anymore, because I would have said, you know, former Shadow Chancellor, former Treasury Advisor, former Strictly contestant, documentary maker, and now cook, chef.
I know.
Cookbook author.
I've just come from doing online a Bank of England seminar on financial regulation on Zoom before going on to the stage to talk about appetite cooking and recipes. And apparently last time I was here, I chaired Norwich City Football Club board last time I was at Cheltenham.
You've covered everything.
Eclectic, yeah? Definitely eclectic.
Which bit do you enjoy the most?
I think I enjoy the variety. I love the fact that there's so many different things to do and huge interests. I mean, the work I'm doing on the Holocaust Foundation with Lord Eric Pickles, you know, we will build the most visited Holocaust memorial in the world, and we've got planning permission now, and that's fascinating. But these days I'm in the street and somebody will say, your souffle rose really well.
I was going to ask about that. What is, if somebody stops you in the street or recognises you, what is it that they're most excited about? Which part of your many aspects of your life?
I remember talking to Natasha Kleplinski about this, who said to me, 17 years on from winning Strictly, the first thing most people will say to her is, you were good on Strictly. And there's something about that show which means you never really escape. And so most often people will yell, keep dancing. And I also still get the, I used to hate you.
Yeah.
And now I like you.
It's interesting. We did an event earlier in the week at Cheltenham about personality in politics. And the role it plays, and it clearly does play a role in part of the appeal. And your name came up as someone who people didn't like when you were a politician. You were seen as quite serious. There was the bruiser and all of that. And then you were only allowed to actually have your own personality when you stopped being a politician. Do you feel like that?
I think there's a really thick piece of glass between the public and people in politics, and that's partly to do with how we see politicians. It's partly to do with how politicians behave, and it just means you never really see through. It's always refracted and weird and cloudy. And I don't think I've really changed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm bound to have changed a bit, but fundamentally, most people know
me. You're a bit diva-ish. The enormous entourage that you've brought with you, and the demands of the rider to come on Times Radio was outrageous.
No, and to be quite honest, Jack Daniels was not what I asked for. But you've given me a stress ball, which
you've got a Times Radio stress ball.
And so a glass of water.
And a glass of water.
Well, only because I asked for the water. You were sitting here met with a glass of water.
That's not water, that's Jack Daniels.
Oh, right, fine.
So you're here at Cheltenham to talk about your book, your new book, Appetite.
And I'm doing a discussion with the Prime Minister's sister, Rachel Johnson.
There we are.
Because Rachel and I were both in the final of Celebrity Best Home Cook.
Yes.
And that's what partly spurred this bizarre thing of me writing a book with 34 recipes in it. But there we are.
But it's part cookbook, part memoir.
Yeah, it's not fundamentally a chefy cookbook, because I'm not really a chefy kind of person. Interestingly, I'd done the cooking show, and afterwards, my kind of editor at Simon & Schuster, Holly Harris, said to me, the big bestseller after the last pandemic in 1920-21 was Theodore Roosevelt's book called Letters to My Children. And he wrote this very thoughtful, reflective book based on letters he'd written to his children about family and life and what's important. And she said, why don't you do something which uses recipes and food to talk about things which really matter to you? And that's what I've done. I'd written a recipe book for my daughter when she was 18. There's only two copies of that. We did a photo book with 64 recipes because she wanted that to take out into the world with her. And so I've used those recipes and some of the stories we told on Best Home Cook. And
well, that was the thing, because whenever all the challenges on Best Home Cook, you naturally told a story when they said, what are you doing? You weren't just doing something. You would just say, I always make this at home. This is the thing, you know, this is what I always do at Easter, or this is it was clearly a very natural thing. The food plays a big part in your story.
I think that's right, and but I think it was true for all of us, actually. Yeah. What we discovered was we really cared because we were on this program and we had to cook something, and it was about being a home cook. And so Rachel or me or Ed Byrne, all of us, we were thinking of the recipes which we'd learned or tried from our mums or dads or whatever, and then bringing them back to the table. And of course, because it was a home cooking show, it's not like MasterChef.
Yeah, it's not all that fussy foams and nonsense.
But you're suddenly faced with this real dilemma, which is, you know, I've done my mum's lasagna, and Mary Berry and Angela Hartnett is about to kind of judge it. And if Mary Berry had said, I don't like your mum's lasagna, I would have said, I don't care. It's my mum's lasagna. And the thing about being the home cook is you actually care more about whether it's what they enjoy and what brings the family together. And somehow that's... it turned out my kids, by the way, were totally against me doing Best Home Cook. They said, Strictly was fine, mum. They said, because we knew he couldn't dance. Yeah. Therefore, he was never going to really embarrass himself that much because he was terrible anyway. But with food, they said, he really cares. And if he gets judged badly, it could knock him.
But this is true. I mean, for as long as I've known you, I've known about the pulled pork. Is it pulled pork?
Pulled pork, yeah. That's in the book.
That's in the book.
Yeah.
And the stories... what's the story about a phone call with Gordon Brown involving some meat?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that was a long time ago. That was the day Peter Mandelson resigned. In December 1998, and Yvette and I were flying out to my parents, who lived out in Italy at the time, and I'd bought this big joint of sirloin beef to take out. And as we're arriving into Heathrow, Gordon Brown had rang me and said, Peter Mandelson has resigned. And at that moment, I suddenly remembered we'd left the beef in Yvette's parents' fridge an hour away from Heathrow. And I said to Yvette, where's the beef? And Gordon said, no, he's resigned. He's resigned. And I then said to Yvette, is it too late? And Gordon said, yes, he has resigned. It is too late. And I then said to Yvette, can we turn back? And Gordon said, there's no turning back now. And that was the beef moment. Oh, my God.
I'd forgotten about that story. I'm pleased to remember that. On the subject of Gordon Brown, and obviously Tony Bennett, have you been watching the BBC documentary? There's a very young, serious chap in glasses who's always just behind Gordon Brown.
I know. I have seen all five of them. We did hours and hours of interviews, but like a year ago, like a long time ago. And because in the old days, I'd have gone in when I was a minister with like a press officer and a recording thing and recorded the 11 hours, whereas... I suddenly thought, I wonder what I said. So you actually watch these 5 hours with your heart in your mouth, kind of hoping you've not said something terrible. It's quite, I mean, we did look very young. My youngest daughter said, why did nobody in the late 1990s wear suits which fitted? And it is true.
It is
Everybody's
amazing.
Everybody's got these big balloon-like suits. Yeah. I think for me, there's lots of kind of issues about good governing and... You know, the Blair-Brown relationship and, you know, did it lead to good outcomes because of the, kind of the creation of that tension, or was it, did it lead to kind of errors? I think actually the bit I find emotional is seeing Gordon's kids walk down Downing Street at the end of the final episode, which has not been on the TV yet. So you have to wait and see it. But people will remember that moment. And it goes back to the thing you said to me a while ago in this conversation, that it was a very, very humanising moment for Gordon.
Yeah.
He had protected his young son so carefully, rightly in my view, from all the glare all the publicity. But it meant that people saw Gordon the politician. And suddenly there was this amazing human moment, giving his sons, you know, the picture for them to remember that, you know, our dad was Prime Minister. Yeah. Look, there we are on Downing Street.
Yeah.
And finding a way to, in politics, to not kind of hang your family out in the public glare and not ever look like you're not taking the job seriously, but also show that human beings, you know, we learn, we make mistakes, we laugh, sometimes we're upset, but that's good. I mean, that's human. Finding a way to show that is very hard in public life, but somehow you need to try.
There's also something about looking at it and thinking, that whole time just seems a million miles away from politics as it now appears to play out. Not just the fact that Boris Johnson is clearly a very different character to Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, but you know, a sort of level of seriousness, maybe the attention to the way of governing. Just seems like a different age almost.
I mean, these days there's 24-hour news and so many blogs and outlets and social media, but actually back then, in some ways, the scrutiny was more intense because of the fact that it was kind of more narrowed and funneled. And you know, if you think of how the huge difficulties we had, if you think of, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners won't remember this, but the Bev Hughes resignation, because when she was the junior immigration minister, a letter went through her office which she hadn't properly read.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's incredible.
It's incredible. The things people resigned for.
Yeah.
The Peter Mandelson resignation, in which Tony Blair says he now thinks was a mistake. I mean, these days, I don't know what it is. There's something about the huge noise of politics, which means sometimes it doesn't come.
Has it
come
almost
back
the opposite effect?
Somehow.
Maybe 25 years ago, you had intense scrutiny from, a dozen newspapers, but at least it was only once a day. Mm. So in the rest of the time, you could probably get on with some stuff. But then there was more of a holding to account. But now there's just so much noise.
Well, you remember what it was like. I remember going to Labour Party conferences in the early period, and somebody would make a mistake on the Today programme.
Yeah.
And that meant we had 3 hours to work out what we were going to say on the World at One.
Yeah.
And, you know, whereas these days you'd have to
do it then.
There'd be somebody
3 hours later,
who knows? All forgotten by then. But actually, the fact that it didn't move so fast meant that sometimes, you know, when the collective view settled, it could settle quite decisively.
Yeah.
And somehow that doesn't quite seem to
doesn't
happen.
Doesn't seem to happen the same way. Because in that 3 hours, 10 other things then happen. And this is a sort of never-ending sort of score.
You could always find anybody on social media who's going to agree with you or disagree with you.
Yeah.
And actually, I think one of the things which really worries me about the nature of modern politics is that if you want to feel good amongst your supporters, you really, really have to hate the other side.
Yeah.
And they're evil and you have to condemn them. But that, and that bolsters you within your group. But how does that progress, you know, our country or humanity? I mean, actually, agreeing is good. Yeah. You know, a consensus is how things change. And at the moment, the nature of discourse almost breaks away from the idea that we should ever agree on anything, because that would be, you know, to betray. I can't agree with them. They're evil.
Yeah. You sound like somebody who probably wouldn't call your opponent scum at Labour Party conference.
I wouldn't, although there is a great moment in 2001 election in the New Labour documentaries where John Prescott punches the guy and Tony Blair's line is, John is John.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes you just have to say, you know,
Angela is Angela.
Well, you said it. You said it. That's what I think I would have said.
Yeah.
But then maybe I'd live through the punch moment.
I can't have you. Love to have you on. Talk a bit about politics, talk a bit about food. But of course, I've got to ask you about Strictly, as everyone else would do if they stopped you in the street. Are you watching it? Who do you think is the Ed Balls character of this series? And who do you think is going to win?
Look, of course I'm watching it. And, you know, I think this year, they've all been, you know, actually really pretty good.
I wonder what they've all spent lockdown practicing.
And the ones you think they're not going to be that good, they end up doing much better.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I went up to the top of Kilimanjaro with Dan Walker, who kind of got me through the final 2 hours to the summit. So, of course, you know, I'm pleased when Dan does well. I've always thought rugby players are good. And Hugo Monnier, I mean, what an outfit he was wearing on Saturday. Yeah, yeah. But he's, I mean, in my mind, I can also jump and do a forward roll. But catches view was always, when my feet were on the ground,
that was
better. I won't
get you to do that now.
So, you know, I actually think the one to watch is going to be Rose. Rose Aileen Ellis.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
I mean, the dunch she did last week was astonishing. And then to learn that the ballroom was easier for her because she doesn't have to count, because she can just feel the music through Giovanni's body. And to have that challenge and then to do it so effortlessly.
Yeah.
And I think probably you have people who are too good. And then you have people who are clearly just never good. And then you have people, and I'm going to put myself in this category, actually, if you don't mind, Matt, who clearly learn and try and get better. Yeah.
And it is the journey that's what you enjoy.
But what the winner is often the person who comes from, you know, a lower base or who doesn't start as a dancer and just emerges and blossoms and end up thinking, I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling, actually, Stacey Dealey did
a
version of that. I think Rose looks really good, and I think she's going to keep getting better. However, Kachu is clear. Her Olympian, is it? Anna Petey. I mean, he was so undermarked on Saturday. What were they doing? I mean, that rumba. It was the one dance I never got to do.
And is my impression...
I mean, basically, Kachu and Yvette agreed.
The
dance of love was never going to be my dance.
Is she the hardest taskmaster of the professionals?
She's pretty tough.
Yeah.
I mean, she's very, very...
That's my impression.
She's
very...
And I think that she... But she's also... I mean, when I was dancing with her, I'd never danced before. We went on the Jeremy Vine show in our first week to talk about everything which was going on. And that was the first time that she'd ever done a live radio interview.
Oh, wow.
And she's sort of been kind of learning and amassing and this kind of nurturing that incredible choreographic talent. But I remember one day, it was actually the Jive, so it was Blackpool week, and she said to me, "You must get more bounce." And we got to Wednesday, and I said, Katya, I can't get more bounce. And she said, "Listen to me," she said, "I've been dancing since I was 7. That's 20 years. Every day I come into the studio and I practice the same moves because I know after 20 years I can still be better. And you've been doing this for 3 days. So pull your finger out and do it more." And I said, "Okay." And I did.
Amazing. With the spectacular results. So you've done Strictly. You've
spectacular,
done a
kind of.
Spectacular is the word.
Nice word.
Yeah.
I'll take that word.
You've done Strictly. You've done a cooking show. What's next in the world of Ed Balls?
The next thing is actually quite serious. I've got Who Do You Think You Are coming up later in, which is an incredibly emotional thing to do. I mean, it's an amazing program to make, and we made that a year and a half ago. But it's been fascinating and very hard. But my big thing coming up, I have done a 2-hour documentary for the BBC, which will be on next month, on the crisis in social care, I have gone and immersed myself. You know, I'm a trained carer now, and I've done...
Properly
on the front line. I've worked for some, you know, a couple of weeks in care homes and been all over, and domiciliary care as well. And, you know, it's not a panorama view of the issues. It starts from the people who live and work and the family members and sees their experience first. So
incredible.
That's my next thing.
Incredible. Well, it's varied, if nothing else.
It's definitely varied. It's definitely varied. And, you know, on my hands and knees, a key moment, I thought to myself, I wanted to be Chancellor of the Exchequer. How did I end up here?
Ed Balls there. Right, coming up, we are in Cheltenham, just away from the Literature Festival. Of course, just up the road is GCHQ. So up next, we're going to talk spies.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You a spot?
What if I say no?
Well, I don't know. You're sitting on a bench with a newspaper. You could be. What are you waiting to meet another spy?
I'm making very complicated numbers to pass on in a peanut butter sandwich.
Yes, clearly.
Well, not now. You're not going to get the sack now. Is everyone in Cheltenham a spy?
They probably think everyone else is a spy. Possibly. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure if you're double bluffing.
We're not allowed to talk about it, are we?
You a spy?
Absolutely not, although I do have a foreign name, so...
Well, that might be enough. But here you are, you're sitting on a bench with a copy of the Times. It's a signal. Are you meeting another spy?
Absolutely, yes. I've got, I have to say, climate change to whoever comes and sits next to me.
Are you a spy?
No.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Definitely not a spy?
Definitely
not. Is everyone in Cheltenham a spy?
There are some.
Do you know them?
No.
No.
I'm not sure what to make about. What are you at, you? So, are you a spy?
I never have been. No.
Never have been.
No. I've thought about it, but it's too dangerous.
So that's what happened when I tried to find some spies here in Cheltenham. But why are GCHQ? Why is GCHQ here in Cheltenham of all places? Well, I'm joined now by David Abritat, the GCHQ departmental historian, who could tell us why. Hi, David.
Hi, Matt.
So I suppose that's the first question. First of all, give us the history of GCHQ, because for a big chunk of it, it didn't officially exist. So how did it first of all come about?
Well, GCHQ stems back to an organisation called the Government Code and Cipher School, or GC&CS, which was formed on the 1st of November 1919 from two small crypt analytic bureaus that were set up during the First World War. One that was aligned to the Royal Navy or the Admiralty, which was Ream 40, and one that was aligned to the War Office or the Army, which was MI1B. And at the end of the First World War, those two organisations were put together and formed GC&CS because the government realised they wanted a code-breaking or crypt analytic bureau to be formed for peacetime work as well as wartime work.
And at what point does that become sort of GCHQ as we know it today?
Well, the genesis of GCHQ, it was a term that was actually being used in the Second World War to try, because Government Code and Cipher School sort of says what it is on the tin. there was a realisation we had to change the name, but that didn't happen officially until April 1946 when we moved out of Bletchley Park into a place called Eastcote in Middlesex.
And when did it come to Cheltenham?
Well, the story behind coming to Cheltenham really stems back to the Second World War, and the Ministry of Works were looking at relocating some of the government departments during the Second World War because of the Blitz. And they moved into the two locations, and because of that they put in a huge amount of telecommunications infrastructure in Cheltenham. And in 1946, when we quickly outgrew Eastcote, we started to reconnoitre other parts of the country where we could relocate to. And one of the areas was Gloucester and Cheltenham. And this location was picked because of that telecommunications infrastructure. There was a bit of an urban myth that one of the directors was a big racing fan and wanted to go to the Gold Cup every year, so I've not found any evidence of that yet.
And your role as historian, explain your background, because you're presumably one of the few people who, despite my best efforts to find some spies in Cheltenham, nobody's going to fess up to it. You're one of the few people who can. So what describe your role, your time at GCHQ?
Yep, so I'm publicly avowed. We've been on a bit of a transparency journey for the last 20 years to open up a bit more about the work that we do. And my role as the department historian is to really convey a lot of our rich history, not just internally into the department, to our staff, to inspire the next generation of signals
You're
intelligence analysts and cybersecurity professionals, but also to educate the public in what we do.
So
thus, I'm publicly avowed to talk like on shows like this.
Yeah. And how has the work changed? Because presumably it's unrecognisable to what they were doing in 1919. The sort of technology, information, all of that, it must be unrecognisable. Or maybe it isn't.
Well, it's an interesting question because the organisation, certainly technology, has moved forward massively. We're always on a conveyor belt of change. Change is a constant in our organisation, as it is with many others. But GCHQ, the current day GCHQ, is really at the forefront of technology and things like the National Cybersecurity Centre that was set up in 2016. It's really pioneered a new approach for the world. A lot of other countries have used that template to take forward in their own countries.
And what about what favourite, given that you have access to the rich history of some of presumably you'll never be able to talk about, what's your favourite sort of nuggets from the history of GCHQ?
So at Bletchley Park, there's a very famous story of the development of the first digital electronic computer, which was called Colossus. It was Colossus for a good reason, because it was a very big machine. So the genesis of that was 1943. They were working on a German cipher machine that was being used by the German high command. Very different from the Enigma, much more complex. And this machine was carrying very, very top-level strategic intelligence and information across occupied Europe. Bletchley needed to crack it, and they did, but it needed a very, very complex machine to help process that cipher. And a chap called Dr. Max Newman, who was one of the most eminent mathematicians in the country at the time, he's actually Alan Turing's lecturer in Cambridge, put forward a specification to task the Dollis Hill research station for the post office. A chap called Tommy Flowers led that team to develop this new machine. A lot of that design of four Colossus was still classified until the early 2000s.
Oh, wow.
We were still using the some of those machines in the early 50s, and it was pioneering, and it's certainly been sort of written out of the annals of computer history because of the classification issue.
So other people have got there publicly,
yep.
But that was going on that was going on behind the scenes, and presumably now the work that was doing you could do on your phone in terms of the massive development technology. Something that used to fill a room is now technology that everyone's got in their pockets.
That's right. We've actually there's a team of engineers at Bletchley who rebuilt a Colossus. So if anyone goes to the Bletchley Park campus, you can actually see a working copy of a Colossus machine, which is, I think, is one of the wonders of the world. Just to see it and see it in operation. I think one of the other famous stories really goes back to the early 1970s, and we all live online now. We're all doing online banking and shopping on Amazon and everything else. The basis of those secure transactions actually goes back to what they call public key cryptography, which was developed by a chap called James Ellis with a bit of support from two other mathematicians at GCHQ, Clifford Cox and Malcolm Williamson. So I'm very proud of that. And again, that was still classified until 1997. So the basis of everything we do now is human beings.
I mean, that was because that was being used to exchange information securely between within the British state, and now that's technology that we use so that I can pay Amazon.
That's right. Yeah, it's the underpinning mathematics behind everything we do.
Does GCHQ like get any money back from that?
No.
Jeff Bezos owes GCHQ a lot of money. Or at least you get some free deliveries. David, it's fascinating speaking to you, and hopefully people have got a bit more of an insight. It's such a weird thing that you can't talk about most of what goes on, which is partly what makes it so fascinating. David, it's really good to speak to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank
on
you,
Times Radio.
Pleasure.
Coming up on Times Radio, we will speak to David Omond, a former boss at GCHQ, about his time there and the threats that we currently face.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio with Strive UK from MasterCard, empowering small businesses for a digital future. Find out more at mastercard.co.uk/strive.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio at the Times and Sunday Times Cheltenham Literature Festival. We're in the Montpellier Gardens, right in the smack bang centre of Cheltenham. If you travel, what, 2 and a bit miles up the road, you'll reach the Donut, GCHQ, the headquarters of our intelligence agency. But what's it really like in there? Obviously, it's a big secret. It's all full of spies doing secretive spy sort of things. But what really goes on inside GCHQ? Well, one man who knows better than most is Sir David Ormond, former director of GCHQ from 1996 to 1997, then later permanent secretary at the Home Office, then a security intelligence coordinator for the government. And he joins me now. Hi, David.
Hi there.
Now, obviously, within the bounds of not getting into any trouble, imagine I did pop up the road, a couple of miles up the road, and went to GCHQ, managed somehow to get in. What would I find? What's it like as a place to work?
You'd find the place humming. You'd find a very diverse group of people walking about, talking, arguing. You'd find a large number of computer screens. And an air of, perhaps I'd describe it as purposeful activity, because what they're doing is delivering intelligence to the government and to support military operations 24/7. So you find plenty of lights burning at night as well as during the day.
And just describe, what is the work of GCHQ? It's been distinct from MI5, MI6... James Bond, the impression of what spies do. What exactly is it that the GCHQ are doing?
Think of it as a digital agency. So it has two functions. One is to provide intelligence drawn from the digital world, and the other is to secure our cyberspace so that we can communicate with each other, we can do business online, and do so safely, despite the criminals and hostile states that are trying to attack us. So those are the two parts of the GCHQ mission.
And what makes a good GCHQ officer?
I think I'd say intellectual curiosity. Obviously, there's deep technical ability. There are many very fine mathematicians and IT experts, but there are also, and linguists, but that sense of curiosity. How do you find out information that other people desperately don't want you to know and may go to extraordinarily violent lengths to stop you acquiring? And those people are the dictators, the autocrats, the terrorists, the criminals, all of those who are actually trying to do us harm. And the only way we can keep ourselves safe is to try and find out what they're up to.
And the explosion in digital information, online exchange of data, whether it's, you know, individuals on their own social media platforms, WhatsApps and so on, but also every business, every country, every organisation which might want to do us harm exists digitally too. In contrast to, you know, GCHQ's more than 100 years old. Obviously, that wasn't the case in the beginning, and you were trying to get hold probably of paper documents back then. Is it easier for GCHQ now that everything is digital? Is it easier to access it? Or is it a different problem now that there's too much information?
There is certainly a problem about filtering and sifting. and using the most advanced technology, artificial intelligence algorithms, for example, to go through very large volumes of data and pick out the one or two little pieces of information which will complete the jigsaw puzzle. It's intelligence work is often described as completing a jigsaw puzzle with many pieces from different jigsaws all mixed up together, and you've got no picture on the lid to show you what it's supposed to look like. That's the kind of intellectual activity that has always gone on in DCHQ and its predecessor, Bletchley Park, for example, during the Second World War. It's in a way because so much more information is potentially available about, say, a terrorist network, how they're communicating, who's in the network, how they're being financed, and so on. So there is potentially more information that can be of use, but the problem, as always, it's the needle in the haystack, and you have to have the haystack before you can find the needle.
And I suppose the haystack has just got so much bigger. And what about, and I know all the security agencies have talked about this, trying to improve the diversity of thought as much as anything. Different people, different backgrounds, different life experiences. Because in any big organisation, there's a risk of groupthink. And I mean, we've even, you know, that word's been bandied around a lot the last week or so, in reference to the government reaction to and preparedness for a pandemic. How do you guard against that in an organisation like GCHQ? I was looking at your book, which I know came out last year, How Spies Think, and you talk in there about how back in the early 1980s, you it was your job to break the news to Margaret Thatcher that it looked like Argentina was preparing to invade the Falklands, and part of that was an admission that you hadn't spotted this as happening before, and maybe that was part of groupthink too.
Yes, I mean, we talk rather casually about groupthink. But what it is, it's a well-established phenomenon that it's quite difficult to stand out against the prevailing trend. And when you've got a group of people who come from a similar background, who share similar experiences, they may look on a problem in the same way. And what you want is a diverse group of people who can approach it from different directions. And you've got people who have the moral courage to stand up and say, actually, I don't think we're on the right lines here. We've jumped too easily to that conclusion. Why don't we look at it a different way? It's a continual struggle because groupthink is one of those cognitive errors which you really don't know you're falling into at the time. And because it's a sort of subconscious activity, you're not conscious that you're just following the herd because you think you're actually contributing. So the answer is you've got to make it a team sport because other people will probably spot your cognitive error long before you do. And there are others, and in my book, I'm going to talk at the festival about it, How Spies Think. I go through some of the problems which there are. Mirror imaging is a very common one, where you think that the other person thinks the same way as you do. And anyone who's bought a secondhand car will know that the way the salesperson trying to sell you the car is different from the interest that you have in buying. And if you don't recognize that, you're probably not going to have a very successful negotiation. So mirror imaging, perseverance, it's a lovely old-fashioned word, it's a medical word, but actually it means clinging to old ideas long after their sell-by date. And this is something that COVID has exposed because at the start, not a lot was known about this new disease, COVID-19. And as gradually information was gathered by the scientists and analysed, it became clear, for example, that this was very largely an airborne transmission of the disease. And that meant rather different measures should be imposed to try and slow down its spread. And this ability to change your mind sensibly, rationally, on receipt of new information it's a really important part of intelligence work. It's an important part of policy work. But the problem is, of course, if you're a government minister and you're subject to the front pages of the red top newspapers, you're liable to be branded, well, this is a U-turn.
Yeah.
It's not a U-turn if it's because actually the facts on the ground have changed.
And you also suggest that the prime ministers and ministers would benefit from having some form of psychoanalysis.
Yeah, that was said slightly in jest, but there's a fundamental principle is know yourself. It's one of my principles of intelligence, the 10 lessons that I put in my book. It's your own demons that are most likely to mislead you. So you have to understand your strengths and your weaknesses and how it is that you are liable to fall into error or be taken in by deception. And in the intelligence world, there are people out there who are trying to deceive us that some offensive new weapon system has different characteristics from those that it actually has. We've seen a lot of deception activity, for example, in the American elections, the presidential election 2016, trying to pretend to be something other than it was, so fake websites and so on. And that sort of information, disinformation activity is still going on. And of course, we've got disinformation. We've got anti-vaxxer movements pushing out material on the internet, which is factually and scientifically untrue.
And where would you say are the biggest threats now? What will be dominating the work of GCHQ now? Because different days, different news cycles, different people, they might say, well, it's China, it might be Russia, it might be Facebook, it might be WhatsApp encryption. What would you put at the sort of, if you were in your old job, what would you be putting at the sort of the top of your list of concerns?
Well, I've got an acronym, CESPIT. Crime, espionage, sabotage, and subversion, perverting internet technology. So if you're a digital agency like GCHQ, you've really got to try and get ahead of the criminals, the risk of disruption from cyber attacks. Ransomware is a real problem now, attacking small companies as well as large ones by criminal groups, looking to profit from, you know, locking up your data. And if you don't pay the ransom in Bitcoin, you lose the data, which may mean you lose the business. So the latest, what I would call digital subversion activities, which are not really, they're below the threshold of armed attack, but Russia has been pumping out disinformation into Europe and into North America. And ways have to be found of combating that. So GCHQ is, I know, now teaming up with the defence, with the armed forces, to create a national cyber force, which will go upstream and try and disrupt those who are trying to harm us.
I suppose that's is that one of the big changes, looking back over sort of your career and even further in terms of the history of GCHQ, the big difference is that if you went back a few decades, actually most people were going about their business unimpeded by the sort of things that GCHQ were concerned about. But because we are now all online, like you're saying, any business could be a target of a ransomware attack. Any individual could be on the receiving end of disinformation or deep fakes or whatever it might be. And so suddenly we're all slightly more bound up in it than maybe was the case in the past.
Yes, I mean, when I joined GCHQ, which is in 1969, the big target was the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact's armed forces. So you're studying weapon systems, you're studying orders of battle and deployments and things like that. That still goes on, of course, with potentially hostile states. But the big change is that we are all, the domestic population, we are all now subject of continuous attack. Sometimes it's criminals, sometimes it's terrorists or people through the activities of hostile states or hostile groups. But that sense that it's public directly that has to be protected is, you know, this is now in, you know, it's in the DNA of GCHQ.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcast from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.